This lecture is called Beyond Mendel, From Reductionism to Holism. Now, Mendel had two laws of inheritance, the law of segregation and the law of independent assortment. And what we're going to do in this lecture is we're going to show how these two laws link with the chromosomal theory of inheritance, and it really opened up our understanding of how genetics works. We'll begin with the law of segregation, which is Mendel's first law. What we know now, and I'm going to sort of talk about, in this lecture, I'm going to talk about it from our perspective, looking back. So we know that chromosomes exist, and we know that genes are on chromosomes, and alleles are on these chromosomes. And so I'll be kind of not talking about it from Mendel's perspective. So I'll go back and forth, really. So let's start with Mendel's first law, the law of segregation. Now, what we know is that two alleles of each gene segregate, and that is really, they separate into two different gamete cells during the formation of egg and sperm in the parents. Now, this law of segregation explains the 3-to-1 ratio that Mendel observed in the F2 generation when he was breeding his pea plants. And if you look at the picture on the right, you'll see the purple flower and the white flower. And we know that, you know, if the parental generation has pure purple and pure white, but the F1 generation will have all purple flowers, but they'll be hybrid, right? There'll be one big pea and one little pea. Now, if you take that F1 generation, which is heterozygous, it's got a big P and a little P, and you cross it with itself, so we call this a monohybrid cross, what you get will be an F2 generation shown below, which is, you'll see three purple flowers and one white flower. And that's true because the large P is the dominant allele. And it turns out also that we see this ratio because alleles segregate. They separate during the formation of gametes. So Mendel, even though he didn't know this, he observed the ratio. And when we actually look at his data, we find something really amazing. We see that he had 705 purple flowers, 224 white flowers, and that gave him a 3.15-to-1 ratio, which is pretty darn close to the true ratio of 3-to-1. Now, I just want to make a note that if you do more and more crosses, you're going to get closer and closer to this 3-to-1 ratio. And actually, it turns out that some statisticians have gone back and looked at Mendel's original data, and it turns out that even though the true ratio is 3-to-1, someone using the number of pea plants that Mendel had, which is about 1,000, 3.15-to-1 ratio, that's actually too good to be true. And so it looks like Mendel, even though he was a monk, a religious person, it looks like he fudged his data. He knew what he should get, and he probably threw out some pea plants or whatever, so that he got close, very, very close to the 3-to-1 ratio. But it turns out he was right, so it's okay. Anyhow, what's remarkable now is that his law of segregation anticipates what chromosomes actually do in meiosis. We know that chromosomes, homologous chromosomes, separate during the beginning of meiosis, during meiosis one. And in the next slide, you can see a really nice illustration of this. On the illustration to the right, you'll see a pair of homologous chromosomes, one with the big R and one with the little r. And these homologous chromosomes are illustrated before the S phase. Remember in the cell cycle during interphase, there's the S phase, and that's where the DNA replication occurs. Well, these chromosomes pictured here at the top, this is before that replication has occurred. Right below it, the replication has occurred. So not only do you see the homologous chromosomes, but you see that each chromosome is really now a pair of sister chromatids joined at the waist, like I say, which is really the centromere, okay? And remember, the sister chromatids are identical, and the homologous chromosomes, the blue and the red, are similar but not identical. And then when you go through meiosis one, you notice that those homologous chromosomes separate or segregate into what will become eventually two separate gametes, for a total of four gametes. And that's what Mendel basically anticipated with his work. He didn't know the chromosomes existed, but you know, here we have it. In fact, it's, you know, it's a powerful piece of evidence that validated Mendel's work. And then in the next slide, the law of independent assortment is Mendel's second law, and Mendel discovered that alleles of different genes assort independently of one another during gamete formation, and that would result, if you do what's called a dihybrid cross, you get the 9-3-3-1 phenotype ratio in the F2 generation. And once again, if you look at Mendel's data, he had 315 to 108 to 101 to 32, not exactly 9-3-3-1, but pretty darn close. Now, if we want to really understand that, we go to the next slide, and we see that the law of independent assortment actually illustrates what chromosomes do in meiosis. And so what I say here in this slide is that the final proof of the chromosomal theory of inheritance really occurred when scientists realized that the independent assortment of homologous chromosomes during meiosis could actually explain the independent assortment of Mendel's units of heredity. And so if you look at this picture, you'll notice on the left, there's two pairs of homologous chromosomes. There's a blue, a pair of chromosomes on the left that are blue and red. And then right below, I think it's looks like green and orange. And if you look, you'll see that on the left, the top pair, it goes blue-red and then green-orange. And if you look to the on the right, you'll see that the top pair is blue-red, just like the one on the left, but the pair below has actually assorted independently. It's flipped around. So now the orange is on the left and the green is on the right. And if you look over on the left, the green is on the left, orange is on the right. And so you can see that these homologous pairs of chromosomes don't have to line up in any particular way. They can choose however they want to line up. And what that causes is, if you follow the illustration down, is different homologous chromosomes will end up in different gametes. And you can see it. It's very colorful here, but you can see it in the illustration. And that is essentially what Mendel discovered as well. He knew that that happened. You know, what's amazing about Mendel, which makes him a real genius, is that he never was able to see chromosomes. He didn't know that, you know, what they look like. But just by using math, using probability, these ratios that we just described, the 9-3-3-1 ratio, he was able to figure out that this must be going on. And so that's why I think people really never appreciated Mendel, because he was highly mathematical. And, you know, when he gave his paper, he read his paper at a little natural history society in what is now the Czech Republic. And those people were biologists, and they weren't really that good at math. And so they probably didn't even understand what he was talking about. But in fact, nobody did, you know, for what, 35 years or however long it was, until 1900, when someone finally rediscovered his paper. But by then they'd seen chromosomes and they saw this crazy stuff going on in meiosis, and they realized, oh my goodness, what's going on in meiosis completely parallels what's going on with Mendel's laws. And that's really, really remarkable. So I'm going to go to the next slide and just describe the chromosomal theory of inheritance. It says this: that Mendel's units of heredity are located at specific places or loci on chromosomes, and that it is the chromosomes that undergo segregation and independent assortment. Okay. Now, this was accepted around 1903, and once that happened, really that was the beginning of genetics. That's when it really exploded. And within 50 years, the molecule of heredity was discovered, DNA, the structure of it, and then 75 years later, genes were actually taken from one organism and spliced into another organism. So it's pretty darn remarkable. And, you know, of course, now, today, you can actually go and get your genome. You can be genotyped with your SNPs. And who knows, probably in the next few years, and this is, you know, for average person like me, I just had mine done. And, you know, probably in a few years, we'll have our entire genome sequenced, our own genome. So it's amazing how far we've come, really just about 100 years now. The next slide is a good slide because it sort of just gives you the basics, call it the beginning genetic terms. And I just want to point out a couple of things here. When you see two chromosomes lined up like this that are, they're similar but not identical, they're homologous chromosomes. And the gene locus is the place on the chromosome where the gene is located. You can see it here. And the actual version of the gene is called an allele, and you can see where the allele will actually be at that locus. And then on the bottom of the picture, you'll see three gene pairs, and you know, you'll see that they have different loci on these homologous chromosomes. And so this is really a nice summary slide. In the next slide, I talk about the idea that all models are partial truths. And while the reductionist approach has given us a foothold in the understanding of nature, in all cases, the models of how the universe works are really imperfect. And if we look at Gregor Mendel's amazing discovery, you know, he discovered the laws of inheritance. It was this amazing intellectual breakthrough. And you know, one of the greatest discoveries in all of science. However, Mendel, he made a model of how inheritance worked, but it was actually it's not perfectly true. He simplified things in a way that got us out of the darkness of not knowing how inheritance worked at all. But now we have to kind of move beyond Mendel. And that's what we're going to do now. And before I leave this point, I want to just make a comment about reductionism. And reductionism is a strategy that works. If we define reductionism, it's an attempt to reduce or explain a complex set of facts, entities, phenomena, or structures by another simpler set. And, you know, the quote here is, for the last 400 years, science has advanced by reductionism, and this is the idea that you can understand the world, all of nature, by examining smaller and smaller pieces of it. And then when you assemble the small pieces back together, you can explain the whole. So the idea of reductionism is just look at the smallest piece of nature, figure that out, and do that a whole bunch of times, and then you can kind of reassemble it and make sense out of it. And it's really powerful. If you think about the major breakthroughs in how we understand nature, people like Galileo and Newton, and even Mendel took this reductionistic approach to understanding the physical and biological world. They broke things down into simple bite-sized pieces that were simple enough to really be studied and understood. And once they understood the simple laws upon which the universe is constructed, then they could build a more complex understanding. So we need to thank Mendel for everything he gave us, but we also need to be willing to go beyond Mendel. And before we go beyond Mendel, let's just go to the next slide and look at what his model said. What did Mendel say? First of all, he said peas have two versions or alleles of each gene. Okay? And this turns out to be true for many other organisms. Good. Number two, this is a huge breakthrough. He realized that alleles do not blend together. In other words, you know, like in our example earlier, you've got purple and white flowers. Purple and white do not give you somewhere in between purple and white. Purple stays purple, white stays white. Number three, each gamete contains one allele of each gene. Okay, great. That's true. Pairs of alleles segregate during the formation of gametes, and that's how it works. We know that males and females contribute equally to the genotype of their offspring. Obviously, gametes fuse, and then the offspring acquire half from mom, half from dad. And then the last thing you noticed is that some alleles are dominant to others. And when a dominant and recessive allele for the same gene are found in the same individual, the dominant phenotype will prevail. So that's Mendel's model. Now, let's see where he was maybe not perfectly right. So I'll call this Mendel's partial truth number one. It turns out that traits are not always either dominant or recessive. And you guys need to know this because oftentimes beginning biology students get into this notion of dominant, recessive, and it's just not true. Okay? What Mendel described in his famous P experiment, we now call complete dominance. And what that means is one allele is completely dominant over another allele, and that allele over which it is dominant, that other allele is called the recessive allele. So the example is, if we look at a trait for plant height, we see that it's controlled by two alleles, and the big T represents the tall allele, and it's dominant over the little t, which is the short allele. And so you'll get two genotypes, big T, or big T, little t, and the phenotype will be the same, tall. And the reason why? Because the big T allele shows complete dominance over the little t. Now, if we go to something that Mendel didn't describe, we look at incomplete dominance. And in this case, one allele of a pair isn't fully dominant over its partner. In fact, it actually looks like blending is happening. The F1 generation looks like an intermediate between the two parents. And the example I'm going to use is snapdragons. And if you look how we notate it here. Red flowers are big C with a superscript R, big R. And white flowers are big C with a superscript W. And it turns out that they're incompletely dominant, which means neither one is dominant over the other. And so the offspring, if you get a CR with a CW, is going to look halfway between them. It's going to look pink. And you might ask yourself, well, wait a minute. I thought blending couldn't occur. Well, it turns out the way it works is this. The CR allele codes for the red flower and pigment, and the CW does not code for the pigment. So if you get an individual with CRCR, the individual gets twice as much pigment and is therefore red. If an individual with CRCW gets only half the amount of pigment and it therefore looks pink, an individual CW gets no pigment and it therefore it looks white. And if you look at the illustration on the next slide, you'll see it's really obvious. You've got a red and white parent, you've got the intermediate, which is pink. And then when you do the F2 generation, it's really interesting because you get one red, two pink, one white. And so that's how that works. Now, another concept which is really important is called codominance. And this is actually a very cool thing. And I'm going to illustrate it using blood groups because blood groups are pretty interesting anyway. And in codominance, what happens is both alleles are expressed in the heterozygote offspring. And if we look at the ABO blood group, it gives us a really good example of codominance. And let me just run you through the basic genetics. I spent quite a while working up these slides, so I think I've done a pretty thorough job of explaining how blood typing works. So I don't think you'll find it any better in any other book. So pay close attention, because I think this will really help. Four phenotypes exist for this character. So a person can be either type A, type B, type AB, or type O blood, four blood types. Then it turns out that these letters refer to two carbohydrates. One is substance A and the other is substance B. And they may be found on the surface of red blood cells. It turns out that carbohydrates can exist on the surface of cells. And a person's blood cells may be coated with one substance or the other, so it could be type A or type B, or they could have both substances on the surface, and therefore they would be type AB, and they could also have neither of them, and then we would call that type O. And you can see in my picture to the right, I've illustrated that. A, you can see, has the A, B has the B, AB has A and B, and then O has nothing. Now, what are the implications in blood transfusions? Because this is where it gets very interesting. It's really important that we match compatible blood groups for blood transfusions. Otherwise, bad things happen. If a donor's blood has a factor that is foreign to the recipient, then specific proteins called antibodies, which are produced by the recipient, will bind to the foreign molecule and cause the donated blood cell to agglutinate. Okay? So that's a mouthful, that's a brainful to think about. But the bottom line is, this is not a good thing, and it can actually kill the patient. So how does this work? Well, if we go to the next slide, it turns out that three different alleles account for four different blood types. And here's how we do it. It turns out that we represent the blood type by I with either a superscript A, I superscript B, or small I. And so it turns out that IA codes for the A carbohydrate, IB codes for the B carbohydrate, and little I doesn't create either carbohydrate. And so, and also, you can look at this, IA and IB, which are capitalized, and these alleles are dominant to the little I allele. So there's a lot of stuff going on here. So what's surprising here to a lot of you is that, wow, all we've dealt with up until now are two alleles for every gene. Well, now we're looking at three alleles for a gene. And so this is also a case of multiple alleles. Very interesting. Not just codominant. In the next slide, we'll sort of put it all together. Let me walk you through this. It turns out that we mentioned before that there are four possible phenotypes, and those are the blood types, A, B, AB, or O. That's easy. Now, it turns out that there are six possible genotypes, and here they are. IA, IA, those are capital I's, and capital IA, and little I, have type A blood. IB, IB, and IB, little I, individuals have type B blood, and IA, IB alleles are codominant, and so they're both expressed in the phenotype of this individual, these individuals, And so they will have type AB blood, and then the recessive homozygous, little I, will have type O blood, because the cell surface has neither the A carbohydrate nor the B on its surface. And you can see my picture here on the right shows it very clearly. And you can see type A blood, you can see the genotype, and you can see what the cell surface looks like in terms of its carbohydrates. I think that's all pretty straightforward. The next slide will put it all together now in terms of blood transfusion. What you see here is type AB, AB and O blood. You see the genotype. You see what carbohydrates are on the cell surface. And here's where it gets interesting. If you are a type A blood, that's who you are, because you have A on your surface, your body has to recognize A. Just has to. So that is self. That means that you produce antibodies for B, because if you ever saw B, you'd attack it. So that's the antibodies that you're going to have in your blood. And what that means is the blood, well, let's just go down. And then for type B blood, because you have B on the outside of your blood, it means you're going to have an antibody for A, because you don't like A, and you would attack A if it were in the blood. And then if you were type AB, since you have both A and B, it turns out that you want to basically attack anything, or you don't want to attack anything, because you look at A and B, and those are both part of you, so you're not going to make antibodies for A or antibodies for B. And then finally, type O blood. O has nothing on its cell surface, and so you want to attack A and B because that would be foreign to you. So you make antibodies against A and antibodies against B. Now, given all that, if we go back to type A blood, we go, okay, well, because that person makes antibodies to B, the only blood they can be given is A, you know, they can be given A, or they can be given O, because if you look at O, O has no carbohydrates on the cell surface. So you can take O. Type B blood will accept, obviously, type B blood, because it has antibodies against A. But it will also take O blood, because if you look at O, there's nothing on the cell surface to attack. And if you look at AB blood, it turns out that there are no antibodies, so it can receive any blood because there's no antibodies against anything. So it can take A blood, it can take B blood, it can take O blood, happy with any kind of blood. So if you have type AB, that's good, because if you're in a hospital and they need to give you a blood transfusion, they can just pull any blood off the shelf and just put it in you. Now, if you're O blood, that's good to help people, but not good for yourself, because you have antibodies against A and B, so your blood will attack any other blood that is given to you. Someone has type A, you have antibodies against A, it'll attack it. You get type B blood, you've got antibodies against B, and of course AB, there you go, will attack that as well. So it is the, now, because the blood itself has no cell surface carbohydrates, you can give this blood to anybody. And so it's the universal donor. Very interesting. Now, let me just quickly review a summary of important points about dominance-recessive relationships. Remember that dominance is on a spectrum from complete dominance, which is the purple versus white flowers, incomplete dominance, which was the snapdragon, where things can blend, and codominance, the one I just gave you, where you have alleles, like in the blood, that will be fully expressed. You know, like AB is fully expressed in the individual. Now, these different dominance patterns will reflect the mechanisms by which specific alleles are expressed in the phenotypes. And they don't involve the ability of one allele to subdue or dominate. So when you hear the word dominance, don't think it's going to dominate, you know, the DNA or something. These different dominance patterns I've just described, you know, determine the abundance of alleles in a population. In other words, they do not dominate the allele frequency. Okay, so just don't get confused by the word dominance. Okay, a couple more points and we'll be done. Pleiotropy. Turns out that one gene can have multiple effects. Up until now, we've kept it really simple, but it turns out that one gene can indeed have more than one effect, and this is the word pleiotropy. And pleio means many, and tropo means change, and so pleiotropy literally means many changes. In fact, it really means one gene, many effects. And the classic example of pleiotropy is sickle cell anemia, where you have one change. Now, this is amazing. You have one change in a single gene. A single gene. It causes a change in the hemoglobin, which is the protein that's found in the red blood cell. So essentially, the gene that codes for hemoglobin, there's one amino acid change, and therefore the hemoglobin itself is different, and that results in an abnormal red blood cell because this hemoglobin's a little weird, the red blood cell becomes misshapen and deformed and takes on, you know, what they call a sickle shape. And the problem with this is the deformation in the red blood cell causes the red blood cell to get stuck in the capillaries. And so therefore, oxygen can't get to the tissues. And then all kinds of crazy things happen. Like you get anemia, heart failure, fever, brain damage, paralysis, kidney failure, spleen damage. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. And so one gene, multiple effects. That's what pleiotropy is. The very last effect is called epistasis. And this means one gene influences the effect of another gene. And the word derivation is epi, upon, stasis, to stand. And so epistasis literally means to stand upon. And what it really means is a gene at one locus alters the phenotypic expression of a gene at a second locus. And that's where we get the idea of one gene stands upon another gene. And the best way to see this illustrated is in an example. So let's take a look at these mice here. The mice have an allele for black coat, which is B, big B, dominant over the allele for brown coat, little b. Now, it turns out that a second gene determines whether or not pigment will be deposited in the hair. The two alleles at this second gene locus are big C and little c. If the mouse has the big C allele, the pigment will be deposited in the hair. The mouse with the genotype little c will be unable to deposit pigment and therefore will be albino. Therefore, one gene and its alleles, in this case big C and little c, control the expression of a gene, which in this case is controlled by big B, little b. And if you look at the Punnett square, you'll see that you get your normal coloration of the mice as long as they don't have the little c, you know, allele combo. But in those four, what happens is it cancels out the pigment, and so the pigment won't be deposited. They become albino. That's it.